All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest on the show is Max Blumenthal. He's the author of the book Republican Gamora and keeps the website at maxblumenthal.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's great to be on with you.
I appreciate you joining us here again. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about recent goings on in Israel. Obviously, that's a pretty broad way to put it, but there have been basically, it seems like there's been escalating strife between the Israeli and Jewish populations of Israel, not in the occupied territories, but the Israeli Arabs have been having some problems. And I was wondering, basically, at least we can start with sort of the lowdown on what's been happening.
Well, I think what we're seeing now is a continuation of trends that have been in place or escalating since the collapse of the Camp David talks in 2000, which is when the peace process really came to an end. And really, it comes out of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the escalating Israeli violence in the occupied territories. But we've recently seen at least widely reported incidents of price tag violence. And I guess, price tag violence, first of all, is usually committed by ideological settlers, Jewish violent extremists, who mostly live around Hebron and Nablus in the West Bank. And when they say it's a price tag attack, they mean that if the state of Israel, the government removes some settlement outposts, or they do the Palestinians any favors, there will be a price tag, and the price tag is usually an attack on defenseless Palestinian civilians. Usually these attacks occur in the West Bank on Palestinian farmers, and the army and the state either turn a blind eye or will come in after such an attack and declare a closed military zone, which forces the farmers to leave and usually serves as a pretext to take their land. The human rights NGO Yesh Din, which is based in Israel, has found that 93% of settler attacks on Palestinians are never even investigated by the state. But these attacks occurred, the recent ones, in Jaffa, where I lived for 2 months, which is connected to the Tel Aviv municipality. So it's right in the heart of Israel. Jaffa is one of the few, the site of enormous ethnic cleansing in 1948. 70,000 of its original Palestinian residents were kicked out, but one neighborhood, Ajami, remained, and it's surrounded on all sides by Jewish neighborhoods. So it's really it's been a target for a long time. And the Tel Aviv municipality treats them horribly. It used to be like the site of the Tel Aviv dump. They've recently authorized, settlers from Hebron to establish a yeshiva and Jews-only apartment complex in the middle of the Palestinian neighborhood in Jaffa, which is really an act of incitement. And there have been, when I was living there, there were weekly trips by settlers carrying Israeli flags, singing ultra-nationalist songs into Jaffa, and they would throw stones at the local mosque. So this is an extension of that. Some settlers from a settlement called Yitzhar, which is absolutely the most violent settlement in the West Bank. So violent, they've even launched homemade rocket attacks on Palestinians, like, you hear Hamas does from Gaza. They attacked a mosque in Jaffa. It was widely reported. And Benjamin Netanyahu was forced to condemn it and say that attacking mosques, goes against the values of Israel, and that Israel supports religious freedom, which is, completely laughable. They don't have separation of church and state there. And the state of Israel destroyed over 250 churches and mosques in the years immediately following its establishment. Church in northern Israel in the Galilee, Israeli troops, after dynamiting it, took its bell and gave it to a nearby kibbutz, and I think they still might use that bell to signal mealtime at the kibbutz. So this is part and parcel of what the state's been doing. Even more recently, in a city called Rahat, which is in the Negev, it's one of the few Arab cities that have been allowed to be created since the foundation of the State of Israel. Most Arab cities are not allowed to expand, and new cities and towns are not allowed to be founded, according to the racist planning laws of Israel. But Rahat was, because it's essentially an Indian reservation for Bedouins who've been forced off their land. It's been built by the Jewish National Fund in cooperation with the state to, as they say on their website, quote-unquote, concentrate the Bedouins. And they built a mosque there in cooperation with a group called the Islamic Movement of Israel, which is an Islamist movement which operates completely legally in Israel. They follow the rules. They don't do anything violent. But because this group had built a mosque in this city, the state came in and demolished the entire mosque just in the middle of the night. This is the kind of thing that happens with state permission. And so my point is, there's a long documented history of mosque destruction and attacks on religious minorities that are state authorized in Israel. And you have a bunch of vigilante fanatics who come out and do it without authorization. And they're basically they're sucking up all the media attention, being blamed, and they recently attacked the Yitzhak Rabin Memorial site in Tel Aviv. So they're sort of going way beyond the pale of what's acceptable in Israeli society. But it's the state that created this atmosphere. It's the discriminatory state that set the parameters. And so I really would point the finger at them for creating this atmosphere, especially Netanyahu, who is, such a demagogue, and who actually, if you want to talk about Yitzhak Rabin, when Rabin was trying to pass the Oslo Accords, which I think was a terrible deal, but nevertheless, it was, a step forward maybe culturally in Israel. Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon held a rally in the middle of Jerusalem, and they stood on balconies, like Mussolini, like classical dictators, denouncing Rabin with an inciting rhetoric, while people in the crowd waved posters showing Rabin in an SS uniform. Less than a week later, Rabin was assassinated, and Leah Rabin, Rabin's widow, blames Netanyahu personally for creating the atmosphere that led to her husband's assassination. So once again, you see him creating a dangerous climate in which people take his words seriously, and violence is committed.
Hmm. Well, now, in this specific case, this town, I'm sorry, what did you say the name was again, where these Bedouins live?
Well, the Bedouins live primarily in Rahat, the ones who've been forced off their land.
Mm-hmm. I was reading a little bit of something about that. It was a very complicated story about how, they had really gotten along with the Israelis under whatever leadership they had back to 1948 for a long time. They've had a friendly relationship there, and they're really being betrayed here.
Yep. Now, the Bedouins,
compromise that they've made.
Yep. Right after the establishment of the state, Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister, implemented what he called his fragmentation policy, which is to split off what he called the Arab nation, to split it into as many pieces as possible, and to pit groups against one another so they couldn't oppose Israel. And two of the groups that whose loyalty he was able to guarantee were the Druze, who primarily live in the north of Israel, and the Bedouins, who had faced ethnic cleansing in 1948 and soon after, but maintained a presence in the Negev desert, which is in the south of Israel. And the Bedouins and the Druze both formed what was originally called the Minority Unit. One Israeli general called it a sword against in the back of Arab unity. And the Minority Unit was the basis for what is now the Israeli Border Patrol. And they went into Arab communities and arrested and sometimes killed those who were called infiltrators, people who were forced out in 1948 but tried to reunite with their families. And the Bedouins then went into the army as trackers, helping mainstream Jewish troops of the army find their way around Gaza. They were especially effective in Gaza and they still have a presence there. But they, in recent years, have been facing enormous discrimination in the army. They're not enlisting like they used to. And they are starting to undergo a process of Palestinianization, and that they are realizing that the state will never repay their loyalty in good faith, and that they're actually part of the Palestinian nation. In the village of Al-Arqib, which where I've been, and I have video of this online. This is a group of Bedouins who've lived in this area for hundreds of years. In 1954, they were forced off their land, and the state said they would let them come back after they did some training exercise. They never were allowed back, so they simply came back and found that their land had been taken. And now, more recently, the state's been destroying their homes. Their village has been destroyed 30 times in order to build a forest for the Jewish National Fund. Many of them served in the Israeli army and are veterans. They're all Israeli citizens. This is the kind of treatment they're undergoing. And now the state has announced through the Praver Plan, P-R-A-V-E-R, that 30,000 Bedouins from the Negev will be uprooted, forced off their land, and pushed into places like Rahat, these so-called development towns, which are actually neo-Indian reservations. The fact that this is going on, that in the light of day, inside Israel, you know, this isn't the territories. And it's not being reported in the U.S. media, and we don't hear about it. It's going to be the most massive campaign of population transfer since 1948. And we haven't heard a word about it in the U.S. media. And I think that's really incredible. But one thing we know is it's destabilizing the situation inside Israel, and we are going to hear about that. We just don't know how.
Mm-hmm. Would it be me going too far to ask you to speculate whether that's really the goal of this policy of turning on them so that they will accept the inevitability that they just aren't Israelis and they're never going to be, and that they'll at least, you know, begin to prepare themselves for the idea of being transferred to the West Bank or somewhere else?
I think Israel's happy to push them into development towns, which are in. I mean, if you see where the development towns that the Arab Jews were put into in the 1950s. These are in faraway places. They're not really close to the centers of economic life in Israel. They're impoverished. The weather is actually worse there. Many of the cities that are the towns that bear the brunt of rockets from Gaza are development towns full of Jewish Arabs who are extremely poor, and they were basically put there as a human wall. And the Bedouins are just the second level of that. And they're there to do, like low level menial labor for, the Jewish only settlements that they plan to build in the Negev, for army families. So they're happy to have them there as long as they remain pacified, under control, and in these faraway development towns. However, there's the Arab Triangle in the north, in the Galilee. And this is really the base of resistance of Palestinian citizens of Israel to the racist designs of the state. And in so many of the, you know, peace process plans we hear about, we hear the phrase land swaps. We always hear that Obama says land swaps. Clinton said land swaps. Bush said land swaps. What does it really mean? Land swaps means that the Palestinian Authority, who are really the subcontractors of the occupation, who will run the West Bank like dictators, will get a small little slice of the Negev that they can't use. In exchange, they will have to take in the Arab Triangle, which is home to 250,000 Palestinian citizens of Israel. And they'll basically take the wall, the separation wall, and reroute it around the Arab Triangle, just stripping 250,000 people of their citizenship, with the authorization of the international community, thereby stripping 250,000 demographic threats away from Israel. And that's really what the state wants to do. That's what Avigdor Lieberman's campaign plan is, his party platform is. So when you hear people say Lieberman is in favor of transfer, it's really a kind of politically negotiated transfer. Or he'll do it unilaterally just by redrawing it himself. But it doesn't actually involve shipping people on cattle cars. The way that can be accomplished is through what we were talking about at the top of the conversation, which is price tag attacks, vigilante violence, just escalating the atmosphere to a point of no return. And that's what's happening in Jaffa. And as I said, I think it's the state that's to blame for creating that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this article in Haaretz by Yossi Melman called When the Shin Bet Really Doesn't Want To. Repeated Shin Bet failures in solving cases of Jewish terrorism disturb and endanger the fabric of Israeli democracy, and the Shin Bet knows this well. But apparently they just don't have the political will to put a stop to this. Maybe, like my conversation with Ray McGovern about Obama, maybe they just like it this way.
Well, they put a gag, the Shin Bet put a gag order on the investigation on the price tag attacks in Jaffa, which means that the media in Israel is not allowed to report on it or report the identities of the perpetrators. So Richard Silverstein, who's a friend of mine and is a blogger and based in Seattle, so he's, you know, not subject to the gag order, to the best, has really served as a repository for people in the Israeli media and activists to get information out, to leak information. He's kind of like the WikiLeaks of Israel. He blogs at richardsilverstein.com, and he revealed that the identities of the perpetrators were settlers from Yitzhar, the violent settlement I mentioned, and that they were recently released by the Shin Bet. After they were captured, they were released. I can say with total confidence that if they were Palestinian, they would not have been released. They would have been placed under administrative detention. Mm-hmm. Another recent Shin Bet investigation. I'm trying to remember the name. Chaim Perlman is his name, I think. He had stabbed to death 4 Palestinians randomly in the West Bank. And the Shin Bet's Jewish division, its division which is in charge of investigating settler violence, arrested him. They tortured him into making some, and he refused to confess. And then they just simply let him go home to his family. They just let him go, and he's still out. And this is a guy that almost certainly committed random acts of terrorism against Palestinians. So there's a complete double standard by the Shin Bet. Meanwhile, most of the people who are active in the Palestinian-Israeli political party, like the Balad party, for example, that Hanin Zoabi comes from, the woman who was nearly attacked in the Israeli Knesset, are under investigation by the Shin Bet. They're just watching them. They've opened files on them. And they're ready to act at any time. This is part of the escalating atmosphere, that the Israeli intelligence services consider any Palestinian activist inside Israel who's a citizen to be a threat to the state, and they're closely watching them.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, and to the West Bank and the larger policy here, you know, when you talk about land swaps and all that as euphemism for relocating people, it seems like even that is still only, you know, step whatever on the list, that really the policy, especially if you're talking about the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, and his party, is it not to ultimately conquer all of the West Bank and Gaza and somehow cleanse those populations into Jordan or Egypt or the sea or somewhere and take those you know, pieces of land for Israeli Jews from now on? A greater Israel policy?
I think that in its inception, the greater Israel policy, Moshe Dayan, who was the defense minister when Israel went into the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, said, we'll make Gaza part of Israel. We'll basically take it over. And Levi Eshkol, who was the prime minister then, initiated a policy to pay families in Gaza to leave. So that was on the agenda. They now realize that they can't get away with that. Palestinians are sort of there to stay, at least in their population centers, and the world will not put up with another kind of mass transfer, as we saw in 1967 and before that in 1948. So what Israel wants to do in the West Bank is to create 4 Bantustans, or 4 ghettos, which are population centers, 4 Palestinians. They'll be completely surrounded with checkpoints and electrical fences. That's Area A under the Oslo Accords, and it's what the U.S. and Israel want to give the Palestinian Authority in a so-called peace plan. Then they want the Palestinian Authority to give up on the refugees. The majority of Palestinians live in the diaspora or are refugees, and they want them to say, you guys will live in these hellhole refugee camps forever, and the UN will have to take care of the problem. And then with Gaza, they want to section Gaza off from the rest of the world and maintain it as some kind of para-state, where either they'll be ruled by some kind of corrupt Palestinian Authority dictatorship, or if they choose Hamas or a third party, even a secular democratic party that wants to resist Israel, they will be besieged, they won't be allowed to export goods, they won't be allowed to fish, etc., and they won't be allowed to leave. And the United States will simply consent to that. And that's what the policy is now.
And that's the plan for the long term, or is it just that they have no plan beyond the medium term?
They have no, what I guess I could say most explicitly is that, I mean, this is all of what we're discussing is, you know, reflections and manifestations and iterations of the philosophy of Zionism. And Zionism created the a philosophy and an apparatus for establishing a state in the Middle East, for establishing some kind of a Jewish state, or a state for basically a settler colonial state. But it leaves no way out. The founders of Israel never really had a clear way out of the predicament and the destabilizing atmosphere that they created. So we're just going to continue to see an intensification of that atmosphere for as long as Israel remains an exclusivist Jewish state. And people who live in Israel, and this is the real tragedy. I mean, what's being committed against the Palestinians is a crime, for sure. But the tragedy is that the Jewish people who live inside Israel will have to live in a state of permanent war for as long as that kind of political system exists. And children in Israeli schools will have to be heavily indoctrinated and prepared to go into the army to subjugate another people. And that's just an enormous tragedy.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't
unless the Palestinians agree to be subordinate, to be pacified, and to just be swept away into the dustbin of history. And that is never going to happen.
Yeah, well, history wouldn't seem to indicate it anyway. But yeah, I mean, this whole thing seems, for that very reason, to be a self-defeating sort of policy. I mean, for example, you know, if Yitzhak Rabin had lived, and if, you know, all things being equal, more or less, he'd done the Land for Peace deal and given up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and tried to figure out a long-term peaceful relationship rather than one of just military domination and permanent threats and hellatry for the Palestinians, it wouldn't have to be this way at all, right? I mean, there's no reason, really, that they can't negotiate about the Golan Heights with Syria. They can't, you know, figure out a peaceful resolution to the situation in East Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, maybe I'm just being fanciful, but it all seems within reason to me if it's not Benjamin Netanyahu running things over there.
I don't think it's a political problem, and I don't think Rabin's Oslo Accords would have actually led to peace. But it would have led to a more stable atmosphere for Israel. The whole, you know, the deal was written on Zionist terms, and it included never letting the refugees return to their property and not be really sufficiently compensated. Mm-hmm. It gave Israel control over a good majority of the West Bank. It didn't call for the removal of all the settlements, and they're really. So I don't really think there's a political problem. And by the way, right after Rabin was assassinated, his successor was Shimon Peres, who forced him to write the Oslo Accords, who pressured him to do it. Rabin was actually a hardliner until Peres explained to him that Israel had to do this or it wouldn't be really accepted for much longer in the community of nations. It would be delegitimized. And the first thing Peres did was enter into negotiations with the settlers, paving the path for Netanyahu to come into power. So there is an ideological problem in Israel. It's the ideology of Zionism, which is predicated on establishing and maintaining an ethnically exclusivist state in the Middle East for people who are generally not from that region and replacing the indigenous population. This is destabilizing, and it leads to violence. The solution is for Israel to become a normal country, a normal democratic country, and to give equal rights to everyone under its control. And that is sort of the worst nightmare of the Israeli leadership. But I think over time, more and more of the Israeli population is going to recognize that it has to do that. And we've seen Nicholas Kristof, you know, in the New York Times, who's not the most radical guy, actually entertain the idea of one state. So this idea is moving more into the mainstream as people realize that two states is not really tenable, especially on Zionist terms.
Well, you know me, I want a no-state solution for all of us, but I guess that'll have to
work. Yeah, yeah, I mean, ultimately.
All right, hey, listen, we're over time. But thank you very much for your time, Max. It's been enlightening as always.
Yeah, you're running one of the best shows I've been on, and I mean, these are always the best discussions, so anytime you want me, just give me a call.
Great, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, take care.
Everybody, that's the great Max Blumenthal, author of Republican Gomorrah, and he writes for every newspaper and magazine you've ever heard of, pretty much. His website is maxblumenthal.com.